New West Group is a nationally recognized healthcare staffing agency with over 30 years of experience connecting clinicians to leading health systems. In 2023, they were honored as the top travel nurse agency by nurse.org. But New West is more than just travel staffing. They excel in placing local, temp-to-hire, and direct talent as well. Discover their full-service concierge approach at newwestgroup.com. Hey, everybody. It's Steve Curtin, the CEO of TravCon and the Gypsy Nurse. Welcome to another edition of the Travel Nursing and Allied Life podcast. Thank you for joining us. This is going to be a great session. We have Toby Malari here. Toby is the Vice President of Government Relations for the American Staffing Association. He has been a guest before, and today he's going to give us an update on all things healthcare staffing related and governmental policy, what's happening out there. There's been a lot going on in the industry the last couple of years, Toby, certainly since in the year or so since the last time we talked. So welcome and appreciate you joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It's good to be back.
Yeah. Well, certainly it has been a tumultuous couple of years in the staffing industry. There's been a lot of ups and downs for healthcare staffing. Obviously, we've got the end of the pandemic, and now we seem to be going back to a place that is in pre-pandemic mode. But in the meantime, government potential legislation, healthcare staffing legislation, that never really stops. And I know that there was a lot going on in recent years about potential travel nurse pay caps and other sorts of things, but we'd love for you to kind of walk us through an update. It's been a while since we spoke last.
Sure. Yeah. And I'm happy to do that. You're right, Steve. It has been, it has certainly continued the activity on the state level, especially. It's really kind of slowed down on the federal level, which is interesting and certainly a good sign. But the state level, I think obviously because their financial concerns are a little bit more, they're felt a little bit more there with Medicaid and Medicare reimbursement. And I will say that, you know, this movement the past probably 18 months to 2 years has really been driven by the nursing home and long-term care facilities. They're the ones that are really finding themselves using healthcare staffing services, particularly travel nurses, more than they used to. They also have a much more set budget parameters than other healthcare facilities do because they're mostly paid through Medicaid and Medicare reimbursements from the state. So their budget's a lot more set, tends to be smaller. And so they're really the ones that, even as we've seen rates drastically decrease and come back down toward what it looks more like pre-pandemic levels, that still is something that they're having a hard time wrapping their arms around. And that's why they're leading this effort to continue to push this reform effort.
Yeah.
And so if I can, I'm going to call up some slides here. And I think what we should do is just kind of walk through a timeline a little bit and let everybody know kind of where we started, where we are now, maybe where we're going, and give everybody a sense of what the market is like from a legislative standpoint. So, you know, this obviously pre-2020, there was very little legislative activity with regards to healthcare staffing. I think primarily the biggest issue that faced states was whether or not they were going to join the Nurse Licensure Compact, which allows, as you all know, nurses to travel between states easier. And I think a lot of people were considering that, moving in that direction. Then you had the pandemic hit, and we had a scenario where obviously everything got put to the forefront. Emergency measures were passed. And I think kind of toward the end of 2020, you had, again, healthcare staffing nurses, specifically travel nurses, really were kind of the hero of the pandemic. You had nurses that were leaving the industry in droves because of the psychological and physical and mental, just impact this was having on them, the pandemic and working in these scenarios, and hospitals and medical facilities were looking all over for talent to come in and actually help save patients' lives.
Yeah.
And so travel nurses responded. And the nurses that kind of got out of the profession, you know, after a little while, a lot of them kind of regrouped, were able to recharge their batteries and thought, I'm not ready to leave the profession, but I'm not ready to go back full time or to the old scenario I was in. And so you saw more nurses and healthcare professionals doing that trying to travel thing. And it was fantastic. You then get to 2021, and that's kind of the first rumblings that we heard of people saying, and again, mostly long-term care facilities and nursing homes saying, hey, you know, these prices that staffing firms are charging for their per diem nurses and for the travel nurses are crazy out of whack expensive. And the facility's response was clearly they're taking advantage of the situation and they're price gouging. And our response was and always will be, our rates increased because the rates demanded by the nurses and healthcare professionals increased. And we were simply paying the rate that was needed. And we said to people all along, you know, as the pandemic starts to wind down and the, you know, the pendulum starts to swing back, you will see these rates decrease. And I think we've seen that. You go to 2022, the really very active year, and you can see those states in red all passed some sort of healthcare staffing legislation, ranging from registration requirements to some sort of ban on non-compete agreements and a ban on conversion fees, to even Oregon getting the authority to set up a nurse rate cap system, which we'll talk about a little bit later. You go to 2023, still continues with a lot of activity. A lot of states, again, some states coming back for the second time, like in Colorado, limiting conversion fees to only 30 days. Other states going on, and like in Texas, just adding nurse staffing services to the price gouging statute in the state, which is fine. We had no problem with that. And then you go to 2024, and what I predicted, and I'm sure other people did as well, we always thought that 2024 was going to be a year where things slowed down a little bit legislatively. Most states are in a shorter session for their legislative session, so they've got to pay more attention to what are considered, you know, must-pass bills. You have a presidential election. You have, you know, all 435 members of the House and one-third of the Senate up for election. So almost every state has a plate full of other things. And so these sessions being so short, we thought, you know what, I think we're going to see a little bit less. And we've seen that. There's less bills being introduced. I think we're up to 7. A couple got introduced late last week. But a much different outlook. And importantly, here's the areas where these bills are focusing on, because we're even seeing a shift in that approach. First and foremost, I think most states really are looking for some sort of registration or license requirement for staffing firms, healthcare staffing firms, which healthcare staffing firms don't have a problem with. They want to know who's in the state, where they are, and they also want to know where they can go to check to make sure that the nurses that are either being placed by the staffing agency or working through the staffing agency, where they can check to make sure those credentials are up to date and things are being, taken care of from an administrative standpoint. And so that's one of the main reasons for the registration. Then they get into what I would call this, we want transparency. And this is really the healthcare facilities who are looking to see, I think part of the problem is they don't understand the model of staffing, and they want to see where the money is going, because obviously they don't, you know, they're not going to just believe us. But we've told them, you know, when you pay a nurse, you're looking at 75% of the hourly bill rate to a client is for employment-related costs, which includes wage, unemployment, state taxes, training, you get those other costs in there. And so they want to see more of that. So they want to see many states that have passed these laws. They want to see what nurses by category are making hourly by client. And then they want to see what the facility is being billed. So they want to say, okay, so ANOVA Fairfax, we want to see all the pediatrician nurses that are being assigned there. We want to see combined what their hourly pay rate is, and then what staffing firms are charging ANOVA Fairfax hourly for those nurses and healthcare professionals. Again, they want to basically look at everybody's books and see what's being charged. Again, one of the other things we're seeing, which we are in total favor of, is they want to make sure that the nurses that are being assigned to places have the credentials that they hold themselves out as having. And so they want to know where they can go and make sure that they have the credentials, that the credentials are up to date, that they are renewed on time, that any kind of continuing education credits are being obtained and recorded, and that's all fine as well. There's a growing feeling that the staffing firms, from the client standpoint, are putting things like conversion fees in place. The healthcare facilities will say they're doing that to keep the employees from moving. What the staffing firm is doing is really kind of protecting their investment in finding the workers. And most conversion fee schedules, you start off at a number and decrease over time and eventually zero out once that investment has been recouped. But if a staffing firm, and we're seeing this because there are states like Missouri that have passed laws banning conversion fees. If you place a nurse in Missouri on that first day, if the client can hire that nurse away and they do, then the staffing firm is left with all those expenses that it took to find and train and place that nurse that are going unreimbursed, and they're going to be hesitant to work with that kind of medical facility again. So you're seeing issues like that that are starting to pop up. And then finally, you know, we have nurse rate caps systems that are being developed both in Rhode Island and in Oregon. Now in Rhode Island, it's like Minnesota. It only applies to long-term care facilities and nursing homes. Oregon is more like Massachusetts and deals with hospitals as well. Other state issues, one of the things that we're seeing a lot, and this is actually, you know, in a sense beneficial for travel nurses especially, I think, is there's a lot of movement in states, you know, is there kind of, they started off kind of looking at nurses and what was going on, and now all of a sudden they kind of turn their attention and they're saying, okay, well, let's look at these facilities and make sure they're doing what they're supposed to be doing. And so you're seeing a lot of these staff ratio bills come about. And what they do generally is call for a committee to be made up of healthcare professionals, representatives from the nurses, whether it's union representatives or just nurse staff, seniority-based, you know, leaders of floors that are assigning nurses, come together as a committee, recommend what staffing levels need to be in place for these facilities based on the hours, right? You have a, break it down into, I don't know, 3 8-hour schedules. And if the ratios are not met, the financial penalties are so severe that it is really imperative that they're met. And so, you know, I know this, one of the problems that we heard, and I'm sure you guys obviously heard a lot of this as well, is during the pandemic when A, nurses were extra hard to find, B, were maybe more expensive than they used to be, facilities were, could be very aggressive in making the nurses do more than they normally do. So let's just say, for instance, normally a nurse assigned to ANOVA Fairfax would be in charge of 5 beds. I'm just making that up. Now during the pandemic, somebody's saying, well, we're paying so much for him, he's going to have to do 9 bets. He's literally going to have to do the work of 2 professionals. And obviously, that's dangerous for the nurse. It's dangerous for the patients. And so this call for these staff ratio bills has really been increased, and we're going to continue to see them. And again, the fines are so astronomical that facilities will have to turn toward healthcare staffing firms and travel nurses, especially for longer periods of time, to make sure that they're not running foul of those ratio requirements. And then, you know, we've started to see states do things like, okay, maybe there is a supply issue. Should we be investing more in nursing schools and nursing faculty? Maybe we need to increase the way we reimburse Medicaid and Medicaid payments. But I'd say the biggest problem that we're facing as not only an industry, but as really kind of like the healthcare profession, is the use of independent contractors or the misclassification of nurses as independent contractors. And I don't know how rampant it is with travel nurses, but I could see it being an issue, because what's happening is, if you are classified as an independent contractor, you are not a W-2 employee of the facility or the staffing firm.
Right.
Which means all the taxes that usually get paid on employees does not have to get paid. So what it means is a facility will end up paying 40-45% less than what they would pay for a W-2 nurse being assigned from a staffing agency. The problem is, there's a couple problems. One, because there's no employer, the independent contractors are responsible for paying their own taxes. And if they're not familiar with that, if the nurse or whomever the professional is that's classified as an independent contractor is not familiar with that, that can be very problematic, because that's taxes you have to pay yourself. So just to give an example, let's say a nurse is making $100 an hour. And let's say generally $11 of that are payroll taxes that are taken out of the hourly rate and submitted by the employer on behalf of the employee for, you know, FICA and FUTA taxes. So now there's nobody to do that. So the employee, instead of being, you know, working for $100 an hour and get a check that's really paying them $70 an hour because all the taxes have been withheld, now they're getting $100 an hour. They're getting everything. Nothing's taken out. But the problem is that you, as the independent contractor, now are going to have to, at the end of the quarter, submit all those taxes on that you're supposed to be paying on yourself.
Yes.
And if you don't know how to do that, or if you're not familiar with that, if you don't know the system, which a lot of people, the first time they go through this, may not be aware of, you can get dinged really badly. And aside from that, one of the other problems is when you are an independent contractor, since you don't have a W-2 employer, things that we talked about before, nobody's checking your credentialing. Nobody's checking if your license is up to date.
Right.
And so you could run into a situation where, you know, maybe a nurse doesn't have the credentials they need for an assignment, but the staffing firm's not going to, there's no staffing firm responsibility. So they're not going to step in and say, hey, just to let you know, they can't do this. Maybe the nurse will do it if they know, but maybe the nurse doesn't know. Maybe the nurse doesn't know what they can and can't do all the time, or maybe they just see the money and they think, well, I can probably do it. And if I need help, I'll ask for help. So this is a problem. And you're going to start to see, I think, states look more and more into this as we go. So I've just covered a lot of stuff, Steve. I don't know if you've got any questions. I think I've got a couple more slides, but before that, let's see if there's anything I can answer.
Yeah, no, I mean, this is a kind of a great overview in terms of what's major focal points have been happening over the past couple of years and so forth. I guess one of the questions that I have is, why at this point in time does there still seem to be a discrepancy relative to healthcare organizations and healthcare, you know, delivery organizations understanding kind of what goes into healthcare traveler agency fees? So there just still seems to be, and we see this within our community of travel nurses and healthcare travelers. There's this, you know, kind of misunderstanding, I guess, that if a staffing firm is billing a facility, for lack of a better descriptor, the staffing firm is getting the lion's share of the bill rate and the nurse is not, or the traveler is not. There seems to be this general misunderstanding of how these bill rates tend to work and how the travel contracts tend to work. And from your observation, why is that? Why does that continue?
It's a really good question. And it's because, quite frankly, they haven't taken the time to look into it and see what goes into it. One of the things that we say to states when they say we want to have you put the hourly rate you charge your client, put that on the pay stub of the nurse along with their pay rate. And we say to them, well, they don't understand what that number means, just like the client doesn't understand what the number means. And right. We talk to the client about that number, and they either don't understand it or they don't pay attention to it. I mean, I've heard so many times legislators say to me, I know somebody who is a nurse who gets paid $50 an hour and the staffing firm is billing $95 an hour, which means they're making $45 an hour profit. And you say, no, they're probably making, probably $2 an hour profit. Uh-huh. And they don't understand that. You sit there and you break it all down. And then they just either don't want to understand or, they just forget about it. And I think the other thing that's come up with these independent contractors is the problem is that now the independent contractor is saying, look, here's a nurse that was making, that was being paid $50 an hour and the staffing firm was charging $95 an hour. We'll give you the same nurse and charge you $65 an hour. And they think, oh, that's great. And the problem is that all the things we talked about, plus at the end of the day, if that nurse gets reclassified as an employee, now you're going to have a fight between the staffing firm and the client as who the employer is. And so it's a combination of the facilities, just are so hyper-focused on money.
Right.
Right. And so they can hear all the explanations, but all they keep thinking is that, this is what I was paying. I'm paying more for this than I was 5 years ago.
Yeah.
And now the pandemic's over and I still am. And this isn't fair. And obviously something's going on here. And, the nurses, they sometimes feel like, the nurses are just traveling around and they're getting, these sweetheart deals to come to places. But that is another thing that they've got to understand. We say this, we make the, really obvious explanations, right? You talk about, if you want to send a travel nurse to the price of a travel nurse going and working in Cape Cod during the summer is going to be less than sending them there during the winter. Because of just supply and demand, the nurses right. want to be there, right? During the winter time, the nurses that live in North Dakota want to come down to Florida. And so they're going to maybe probably not be paid as much because the location is everything. And there are some places, quite frankly, that you're always going to have to kind of overpay to get people to come to for whatever reason. But I think, really just there. Everybody's so hyper-focused on dollars and budgets that they just don't get it.
Well, and you bring up another point, which is that supply and demand. I mean, it's I've been in and around the healthcare staffing and healthcare online community business for a number of years now. And, you know, for the time that I've been in it, which is over 15 years, there has been an issue with supply of healthcare providers. There are just simply not enough nurses, not enough allied travelers, whether it be PTs, OTs, SLPs. There's just not enough. And we have an aging population that is living longer, requiring more care. Providers or the clinicians are they're burnt out, particularly after the pandemic. They're leaving. It's an aging clinician force. So it's this kind of perfect storm, if you will, of the need for caregivers and the lack of available caregivers. And it does go back to the supply and demand where, if they are needed, people do have the ability to ask for a higher rate of pay. I mean, that's mm-hmm. that's kind of the way that things work. But they're, for whatever reason, within the healthcare world and healthcare staffing world, it just seems that equation, people, at least from my perspective, continue to have a hard time getting their arms around it.
Yeah, they absolutely do. And, you know, when we talk to our members who our healthcare members, you know, they will say, look, the rates have come down drastically.
They have.
Huge, huge decreases. But a lot of them are still above 2019, 2018 levels because you had a shortage at that point that was only exacerbated by the pandemic. And I think one of the issues, and we talked about it briefly, is, we live not far from a couple of universities that have outstanding nursing programs, but they're limited in how many students they can take.
Yes.
And so when you hear stories about, 400 or 500 nursing students that didn't get into a school because they couldn't take them, I mean, it's mind-boggling because yes. that's, and then they're like, oh, well, I'll come back next year. And then they don't, right. They start taking business classes or they do something else and maybe they right. go off in another direction. So,
well, and on top of that too, just as another observation that we see within our travel nurse community at the Gypsy Nurse and at TravCon, certainly the burnout rate is high and it was exacerbated through the pandemic. And I believe that the quit rate, particularly for new nurses within their first year or two of being in the nursing profession, is quite high. Yeah. So you have this lack of throughput, but then there is a churn of people that are immediately leaving, unfortunately. So it's such a difficult situation with the increasing need for nurses and other, healthcare clinicians, the lack of throughput, the quit and burnout rate. It's just, and really, again, I've been around it for a while. It just seems to continue. I don't know what the solution is. And maybe you might want to touch on that in terms of, some of these potential educational bills or what have you. But it's going to reach a point where, if it hasn't already reached a point where, there are just simply the need for the clinicians outweighs the supply drastically and things mm-hmm. start to break down.
Yeah. And I think we're close to that happening, quite frankly, from what we've seen. And it's the entire kind of healthcare infrastructure.
Yeah.
I mean, you had people, the support staff or the orderlies or the techs that were, working in these facilities making, $18 an hour. And now all of a sudden, because of the pandemic and because of other things, they can go work at Target for $16 an hour and have kind of, and they're like,
if I less stress
with the stress and the depressing nature, sometimes it comes with these assignments, like it's worth $2 less an hour. And a lot of times they're getting paid the same. So right. It was really, really kind of a no brainer. But it is a very good point because there's so many pressure. There's so much pressure on these professionals and it's an aging population. that we've got to, you know, I think it was kind of equivalent to, you know, when everybody 15 years ago wanted to be, you know, an engineer or a technical major, because that was,
right.
You know,
software was, developer, right?
Yeah, everything, right? Well, we need to do that with, you know, with nurses and healthcare professionals now, because it's headed to a place that's going to be, it's going to be bad.
Well, you talk about an aging population, the nursing specifically, it's an aging population within nursing. I think the average age of a nurse is somewhere in the neighborhood of 52, 53, which doesn't seem old to me because
right.
I'm in that range. But nonetheless, when you look at a, you know, a nursing career, some folks in their 50s are approaching, you know, 30 years in an incredibly demanding profession. So anyway, it all kind of builds to this negative perfect storm of supply and demand and bill rates and ratios, and it's just you know, I really see it kind of starting to form into a very difficult situation.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you said that about ratio bills, because you know, I think we don't get involved or advocate on staff ratio bills. But in a way, they really are, you know, they're well-intentioned, but they can have some drastic kind of consequences, because you are, you know, really kind of taxing your system because the fines are so, you know, the fines can be like six-figure fines.
Yes.
And so, you know, they will do whatever it takes to hit those ratios. And that's certainly good for our members and for the nurses that they get to benefit from that. But if you can't do that, you know, they're the kind of fines that could shut a facility down fairly easily. And, you know, what are we doing with those fines? Are those fines being reinvested into
good
nursing
point.
Programs and yeah. faculty? That would be great. Right. I don't know that they are, just because I haven't seen all the state's language. But, you know, there's got to be more of an investment in the infrastructure of healthcare.
Toby, I know you have a couple of other slides to go through, but before we continue, and probably I should have talked about this up front, but can you tell our listeners and viewers a little bit more about the American Staffing Association, what it does for its members, and in particular, your role as Vice President of Government Relations?
Sure, I'd love to. ASA is the trade association for the temporary staffing agency world, the industry itself, nationwide. You know, we have about 1,500 members, and we advocate on behalf of the industry. We advocate, educate. You know, we do conferences where there's education. We've got our staffing law conferences next week in DC. Actually, we'll be having a healthcare seminar, a 4-hour seminar. A pre-conference, we're going to have about, I think we've got about 90 people enrolled for that. Educate them, kind of going through what we're going through here now. We have a 5-person legal department at ASA, and my job is I'm the primary advocate for the industry. And our kind of members are divided up into sectors, and the healthcare sector has long been you know, the fastest growing. It's been the biggest for a couple of years now. And certainly ever since the pandemic, it's been the most targeted with regards to adverse legislation.
Yes.
So I have become, I wouldn't say an expert, but we've certainly spent the predominant amount of time over the past 4 years legislatively dealing with healthcare issues and trying to educate lawmakers about these issues. And it's interesting, because when you talk about Medicare and Medicaid, you know, the one thing I've seen over the past 4 years are these issues, you know, they're just as popular in red states as they are in blue states. And in some cases, you know, they're it's kind of counterintuitive, but you're dealing with taxes, you're dealing with, you know, government funds that are being spent. And so you see places like a Kansas that for 3 years tried to pass some really restrictive healthcare legislation. And so our job is to go in there and educate lawmakers about, you know, well, you may accomplish this, or this may be what you think is going to happen. Here's the unintended consequences, which you really have to be careful for. And there's no better argument for or example of that argument than rate caps. And so, yes. You know, we say, look, you will certainly accomplish your goal of knowing how much you're going to pay. But that's not going to matter because nobody's going to work for you.
Yeah.
And they're all going to, you know, go next door to a state where there is no rate cap.
Yeah.
And you're going to end up causing much more trouble.
And just as a comment, I have, and this is not a biased comment relative to, you know, being an advocate for one component or the other component, you know, but this idea of rate caps, I've never, I don't know of any other industry where you can frankly limit the amount of money that an individual frankly can make. Because at the end of the day, this will come down to what the clinician can make. And it does kind of amaze me to hearing this discussion over the past few years about the introduction of these rate caps. I mean, it's just mind-boggling to me that those sorts of things are entertained, you know.
So yeah,
know and what your perspective is, but
oh, it's maddening because you know, one of the premises that drives their arguments, proponents of rate caps, is, well, if the rate caps were in place for temporary staffing firms, the nurses would just eventually all come work directly for us. And we know that's not the case. We know that's just not what would happen. They would literally go across, you know, if we had rate caps in Virginia, you could literally, depending on where you are in the state, you could go work in North Carolina, West Virginia, Maryland, DC, you know, with no time at all, Kentucky, with no rate caps. So the thought that all of a sudden these nurses that, and again, the other mind-boggling argument is that anybody who works for a temporary staffing company does so because it's their only option. That is a premise that we have proven incorrect time and time again.
Yeah.
And actually, when you think about it, there's no better argument to disprove that than travel nurses. Travel nurses do what they do because they want to.
Very much so. Yep.
Right? That's it. And for whatever reason, they can, you know, I gave the silly example before. You may have somebody that wants to be like, I want to be warm in the winter and I want to be somewhere temperate in the summer. And so I'm just going to do that. You may have somebody, you have some thousands of stories, right? I want to work when my kids are in school, but when they're home in the summertime, I want to be home with them. But otherwise, like, you know, when they're in college and stuff, I can go pop over here, do whatever. So this notion that, you know, oh, they only work for a temporary staffing firm because that's all they can do. It's not. So the notion that if the temporary staffing firm was not available, the nurses would just go and work for the facility directly is preposterous because they would just go somewhere else.
I agree 100%. We may have talked about this during your last appearance about a year or so ago, but we did a study called The Voice of the Travel Nurse, in which over 1,000 travelers in our community weighed in on different aspects of traveling. And certainly, you know, while pay is an important issue, there were a variety of reasons that travelers decided to travel. Just to your point, the flexibility, staying out of the hospital politics, if you will, the opportunity to, you know, perhaps take time off. Maybe they take the summer off or something. See different cities, experience different teams, new experiences. There's a whole variety of reasons why travelers travel, aside from the financial component, that regardless, you know, it would not force them, but, you know, it's not their only option. They do it for a variety of different reasons. So it's amazing in some respects, some of the misperceptions out there about healthcare travelers. I do know that you have a couple of more slides if you want to continue through those, and then I have a couple of other questions for you as well.
So, you know, the interesting thing is, I mentioned earlier that, you know, at the height of the pandemic, the federal government looked to be getting involved in these issues. We had the now chief of staff of President Biden, who was at the time, I can't remember where he's working for some, he was in the healthcare field somewhere in the government, he wrote a letter asking the Federal Trade Commission to investigate healthcare staffing firms on charges of price gouging. Uh-huh. That was the first one. Then we saw a couple of GAO studies, and they have finished their report on the use of travel nurses, and they've interviewed a bunch of our members, and I'm very interested to see what that will bring, because we just know from what little conversation we've had with folks that, you know, it sounded very much like the conversation you and I were just having. Uh-huh. You know, why do people become travel nurses? What does it mean to be a travel nurse? Uh-huh. What do travel nurses look for in an assignment? You know, all these things that they want to know, because, you know, they're saying, they're trying to figure out, you know, is there something kind of artificially propping up this travel nurse industry, or is it really a way of lifestyle that people are picking and choosing? So it'll be interesting to see how that comes out. Uh-huh. There's been no legislation on the federal level to deal in a negative, what we would consider to be a negative.
Yeah.
You know, some of these bills that we talk about make it easier to, you know, the federal government trying to make it easier for nurses to work across state lines. And I think that the what was a combination of, you know, some tougher immigration policies in the previous administration, then came COVID and obviously the concern about international travel. But, you know, the industry has a huge pipeline of foreign nurses that come into the U.S. to work. And quite frankly, you know, as we've talked to members of Congress about it, they tend to work where it's often harder to get people to go to, right? You don't need nurses from Guatemala to go work in San Diego or to go work in Miami. Like, that's not necessary. You may need them to go work in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, or uh-huh. or Duluth in the wintertime, or any place where, for whatever reason, it's hard to get people to go on assignment. So, you know, that's an area that they're looking at. You know, is it time now to go back and kind of look at getting those visas back up in order, making it easier for people to come in to the United States? And now the federal government is also, I think, going to start looking more at the use of independent contractors and healthcare staffing. Because, you know, I think one of the primary tenets of being an independent contractor is that you don't need direct control and supervision, right? One of the easiest examples of an independent contractor that they'll give you in law school is a plumber. Because when you call a plumber, you know, you're like, hey, my shower drain is stopped up. Uh-huh. Fix it. You don't sit there with the plumber and be like, all right, I think you should use that.
Right.
Wrench now to try to take, you're just like, curious, fix it. And the thing is, then they charge you whatever it is. And they, you know, they come when they come, they'll give you a window of time. You're not the only client. So all these things that are tests that need to be passed really don't fit into healthcare professionals. And I think that's a reason why we're going to start seeing that even more. So that is the last slide I have. I will tell you from what we've seen this year, and I've just been putting this chart together for our meeting next week, we saw an interesting healthcare bill introduced maybe 2 weeks ago in Michigan, a week and a half ago. And it was kind of a full, what we call, like, you know, soup to nuts, registration requirement, reporting requirements, no conversion fees, no non-compete agreements. And it also had a rate cap system in place. The rate cap system was absurdly low. I think it was like 25%. over the hourly average wage, which again wouldn't cover the mandatory taxes.
Right.
But the interesting thing in Michigan is they specifically excluded the cost of travel nurses from the cap. So what they're basically saying is you got to put everything into this rate except any charges for travel nurses. Now, the reason why that's interesting is because in Iowa this year, we were able to kill a rate cap bill that was 150% of the, I think, average hourly wage for the position. But they specifically said that everything, including cost of travel nurses, had to be rolled up in that rate cap. Huh. And that was one of our stronger arguments was, look, you're not going to get any, travel nurses will just stop coming to Iowa because no staffing firms will be able to afford it. Travel nurses aren't going to take a huge reduction in pay just to be able to travel. I mean, as you said, they've got plenty of other options. So we're starting to see a little bit more knowledge, a little bit more awareness of the role that travel nurses are playing. Sometimes it's like bad, like in Iowa when they were trying to put the squeeze on travel nurses. And other times, even though it's a bill that we don't like and we're going to fight against, the fact that Michigan was wise enough to say, oh, by the way, these rates, you don't have to put in the travel costs in this rate, just shows me kind of the role that travel nurses are playing and kind of the acceptance or the acknowledgement they're receiving from legislators, which is certainly a good thing. And, you know, we'll be interested to see the GAO report. It's also important to remember the GAO report, Congress has this, the General Accountability Office, and its job is just to write these studies. It's not necessarily going to result in legislation. Uh-huh. It's not legislation itself. It's really just a report. But it will certainly be something that we read and pay close attention to and make sure that we have lots of arguments for when states introduce bills. You know, anytime you can pull from a GAO report, it's going to be pretty good fodder for rebuttal. So I think, you know, that's kind of, you know, next year, we're waiting to see if the momentum comes back. Because again, I think we have like 8 or 9 bills this year. There is a bill pending in Massachusetts. There were a couple of bills introduced last year in Massachusetts and rolled over this year. And one was kind of going to redo the whole way travel nurses were paid and what their expenses were and how the travel nurse system worked with the rate caps there. I don't believe that's going to go anywhere from what we're hearing, but we're certainly keeping an eye on it because it would have a drastic impact on the travel nurse industry and would certainly have a drastic impact on the healthcare delivery system in Massachusetts.
Well, Toby, fantastic information. Was there anything else that you wanted to cover through your slide deck here? Because I do have a couple of questions.
No, for I'm done with that, and I'm going to actually – let's see, there we go. Yeah, so that was just some stuff I put together. If people have other questions, of course, they can always give me a shout. I'm happy to, you know, help answer them or send them information if we have any.
Well, and that's part of it. So, you know, I'd be remiss in saying, you know, the American Staffing Association, obviously a great source of information and support for all staffing firms out there, not just obviously healthcare related. How do organizations become a member of the American Staffing Association?
So it's simply an application process and you have to have a staffing business. You don't have to just be a staffing firm. We have lots of firms that are, you know, do consulting or maybe even do some PEO work. And there's a formula used to determine dues. But it's really just an application process and an approval. And, you know, we have literally members that, you know, probably have 3 employees and maybe place 10 people a year, all the way up to, you know, your largest members. But healthcare is the area consistently over the past 10 years that has been growing most.
Yes.
And seeing more of our members there. So that's certainly good.
The other question I have is, you know, as we look out to the future, and you've given a great overview in terms of where we were and where we may be headed. But what advice would you give to the owners of or operators of healthcare staffing firms? What should they be on the lookout for in the next, say, 12 to 18 months as we kind of navigate through this new administration, obviously potentially coming in and, you know, elections and so on and so forth? What advice would you give them, to be on the lookout for, number one? And then number two, I'm assuming that the ASA is a great place to kind of stay ahead of these things and stay ahead of the developments as they occur. So we'd love to get your perspective on that.
Yeah, sure. It's I'd love to give my thoughts on it. I think that a couple things. I don't know of many verticals that have a better story to tell than healthcare staffing firms. Mm-hmm. Because all they are doing are putting people to work that help save lives and help make people healthy.
Yes.
So that's, you know, first and foremost. And again, as we talked about at the beginning, you know, travel nurses and healthcare staffing firms and professionals for the good first 6 months of the pandemic were the absolute heroes. Yeah. But they're heroes every day. And they should be. And we talked about nurses that go places that if they weren't willing to go to certain healthcare facilities, the facilities would not have the professionals they needed to stay open. So it's a great story. And the healthcare staffing firms that are, you know, that do it right, take care of their employees, and they've got a great story to tell. I think the what they're going to have to look out for is more of their clients starting to push back on whether they need them or whether they can just go to apps and get, you know, people referred as independent contractors for 40-50% less.
Or internal pools. We're hearing a lot about that now. These the HR organizations within the facilities forming internal pools of talent and so forth.
They never work, but yes, that doesn't mean we don't pay attention to them. But so there's going to be those challenges. And I'd say from a legislative standpoint, just making sure you tell the story of what you do. And because, like I said, it's a great story. I don't think certainly not in the foreseeable future, you know, there's not an answer to the nursing shortage that we have.
No.
And so the role that travel nurses and healthcare staffing professionals play is only going to get more important. And I would say, and again, I know that they do this, but, you know, there is going to be there will continue to be a microscope on the industry. So you want to make sure that you're complying. And, you know, for some of the bigger firms that are everywhere, it's not a problem. For the smaller firms, it's not a problem. It's those, you know, medium to big size firms that maybe you're in 20 states, 25 states, you know, that's a real compliance issue because you don't have all the resources just to take care of everything, but you don't just have three or four states to worry about. But compliance is going to be so important because they're going to be looking for, you know, obviously good reasons and bad. They want to make sure that everybody's compliant. And so whether it's joining an organization like ASA or whether it's just putting a compliance team in place, that is going to be able to say, okay, here's what we need to do in Louisiana. Here's what we need to do in Kentucky.
Yeah.
Because again, it's going to be continue to be a red, blue, purple state issue. It's not going to be something where, you know, most employment issues that we face, you know, we know they're going to be 10 to 12 states where they've really got a chance to go. But that's not the case with their staffing. It can go anywhere. So I'd say just compliance is going to be critical as we move forward, because not only for you as a staffing firm, but when you have a client, and if this pressure on the independent contractors comes to play, the client is going to be looking at compliance success of a staffing firm a lot more when they're looking for a staffing firm to partner with. And so I think that'll be very important.
Toby, as we wrap up here, I want to thank you for your time. I know you're a very busy person and you've got some big events coming up, but to take the time to speak with us and educate us in terms of where we're at with some of this pending legislation and what to look out for and so forth, it's really invaluable. So I want to thank you for your time. I'd love to have you back as well. We know that the legislative world changes very rapidly, and there's nobody better than you to keep us updated. So really appreciate your time today. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Steve, very much. I love coming on here and speaking with you, and Rachel's great. So anytime you need me, just give me a call. Always happy to talk to your folks, and really appreciate everything that you do and they do for us. And again, always happy to answer the phone or an email as well. If anybody's got a question, just let me know. But I look forward to speaking with you soon.
That is great. And what we'll do is we'll put this information on how to reach you in our summary and when we post this particular podcast and webcast version of this. So as we wrap up here, he is Toby Malara. He is the Vice President of Government Relations at the American Staffing Association. My name is Steve Curtin. I'm the CEO of the Gypsy Nurse and TravCon, the Travel Healthcare Conference. And this has been another edition of the Travel Nursing and Allied Life podcast. So we thank you for joining us. We hope this information has been helpful. And Toby, yeah, we'll definitely have you back.
Sounds great. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you very much.